laws sent to them in the email, except Sean, who's claiming he didn't get the attachment. This one came right after the previous meeting. Janelle sent it out with the
separate email.
All the things. Okay. The discussion was the member at large election, and it is just one person from the commission for an executive committee if there needs to be an executive committee. It's in the bylaws that an executive committee would be the chairperson, the vice chairperson, the chair of the budget, the corresponding secretary, and one commission member at large.
So it was not a member of the commission, it's a member of the executive committee of this body. That was the clarification.
Yes.
So we do need one of them as well.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's someone who is not on the commission? Someone from the commission.
Somebody from the commission.
It is someone from the commission, yes.
And who are our current officer list?
So Shelley Hughesby is a chairperson. Richard Engen is the vice chair. The chair of the budget committee is Sean Muskey. The corresponding secretary is Jill Benson. Is there a nomination?
I would nominate Barbara Little for member at large.
Okay.
Second.
Do I have to accept?
Well, you might object.
I accept.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is there other discussion? Okay. First and a second and an acceptance of the nomination. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Barb. Okay.
The bylaws, or if they want any changes.
Okay. Did everybody but Sean have a chance to look over the bylaws? The revisions were approved in May of 2016, but were there any other revisions that anyone had? Okay. We do have a meeting scheduled for next Tuesday to act on some of the discussion that we hope to have tonight with the commissioner. And that'll be at 5 o'clock here also. Is he here? Okay. Maybe what we want to do is go over the questions that were posed. Jill, these are the questions that you sent in, is that correct? Okay. And if there's any other questions that people have while we're waiting for the commissioner. Is everybody? Seems like this is a good representation of the issues that have come to us and the questions that have come to us over the past year.
I'd be interested to know what other commissions around the state deal with, what kinds of issues they've addressed.
Should we share this with the audience?
Sure, go ahead. I can read them. I could read them too. Or somebody.
Here, here's one to get.
I got an email from
okay.
Jason Baskin, who is the chair of the Austin City Human Rights Commission. And I think it's interesting as we find our way. They've just begun, and they would like to know what the Wilmer story is.
Short.
And they basically said that they have heard that we are the model of what human rights commissions are.
Well,
the state of Minnesota. So just letting you know,
Who is spreading that rumor? Yeah.
Probably that same club.
So I have no idea what that is.
Right. Hey, at least we've got the commissioners, right?
I'm just letting you know that I feel really awkward. They want me to talk at their meeting next Monday, April 24th at 6:15. I don't feel very qualified to accept this. I'm just letting you know that we can certainly meet with them. They feel they have very similar demographics as Wilmer and think we would have common experience. I said, that's probably true, but I said, by no stretch of the imagination should we be seen as the model Human Rights Commission as we just started it really active a year ago. But I just thought I'd let you know that apparently on the state scene we're somewhere. So there it is.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
Well, I think it might be reassuring to them to know that, you know, there's still some, you know, trying to figure us out, and they're going to go through that. They might need to be informed of that, that it's not going to jump in and you sit and everything comes to you. That's great. I think the main thing that has been going on, I think, is just the evidence of a concern for human rights in our community. And I get that from people that I meet out in various places, in church and meetings. So, and I think that is kind of like an underlying benefit that we have that maybe some other communities don't. In Austin?
Yeah, Austin, that's okay.
They could, you know, get their foundation going too, sure, by just gathering and making sure everybody gets their notes and stuff, you know, things like that.
Yeah. So, I guess I can accept their agenda, but I'll qualify it. There's not a secret recipe, and we are not that far down the road ourselves.
Right, we're just beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If anybody else would like to join me next Monday at 6:15, I'm sure it'll be by Skype. I'm not going to drive down to Austin to let them know that we're journeying with them.
St. Cloud is one thing.
Yeah, right.
It'll help after tonight's meeting to
get a picture
from the commissioner.
Well, the gal from St. Cloud was impressed that we had council members on the commission, and she said that should be the model for the state. So that may have, I remember
that's
her saying that.
Right.
Maybe that's it.
It needs to be more than that.
I wouldn't want to shortchange either that. I think we've tried to reach out to educate ourselves on what we should do, you know, inviting the police chief and obviously, the commissioner tonight, the imam, you know, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily shortchange that either. I think that's progress.
I understand. I just think as a model.
Right.
I mean,
yeah,
that
model
was the
terminology is a giant term.
Right.
Model.
Hyperbole.
I don't know
about the model.
Okay.
He's on his way.
Left at like 2:45, depending on traffic.
Well, I did talk to him last year when we started, and he was very, very candid. He seems like a really great person.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I have something I'd like to say. I'm affiliated with the Women's Soccer Association. If you don't know that, it's an association that's been around for about 15 years. It has a spring soccer season that attracts, of course, a lot of Somalis, a lot of Hispanics, Latinos, and both girls and boys. They provide soccer opportunities for children 8 years old to 17. And approximately 225 children currently in the program, with 7 teams, as I recall. Some of them travel. We've had championship teams from Wilmer in just the past few years in some of the divisions. And we also have in the small, in the smaller sided youth program, co-ed soccer, both for boys and girls just play together. They're much more informal, smaller goals, smaller fields, easier for me. I help as a soccer referee, and so I like those small sided games. So if you have an opportunity to support the Wilmer Soccer Association, I consider it one of the best integrators in this city, and it shouldn't be a secret to anybody on this board. Jeff Stoffnecker, who is a local businessman, is the president, and we have a past president here, Charlie, who's also active in the Wilmer Soccer Association.
So what age group does that take in? What stage?
Oh, it's from little kids, 8 until 17, high school kids. And so there are different teams for each age, and the older teams, the 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, those are all segregated by gender. I haven't had any identification issues or transgender. We haven't crossed that bridge.
Is the Wilmer Park system friendly with soccer?
Oh, yes. There's a full soccer program in the fall for high school. And they have two new fields that they just built in the last few years at the high school. They've just taken one of the extra fields for a new building at the high school, but you'll also know it at just east of the Dorothy Olson Aquatic Center, there are two very impressive soccer fields, and they have they're completely lighted. They have aluminum stands. I understand that was all donated by Jenny O. The fields have been recently refurbished. They're regulation fields. They're busy all the time. During the spring, the youth soccer program has games most nights. Sundays reserved for the adults.
Who organizes the adult program?
They do it themselves. The all the those fields are maintained by Park and Rec, and so they do a good job with that, but there's a lot of activity, a lot of interest.
Dave, I was approached by a couple groups about the adult group, maybe not the association, but they had a lot of concerns about winter indoor soccer. And I understand that. Have you ever had those issues with the association?
Had any indoor soccer. The YMCA currently has a soccer program Saturdays.
Right, and there was some difficulty with scheduling, but it's my understanding, I think that the new school building that's going in was going to be able to accommodate indoor soccer as well as part of that. So maybe your program could expand to include multiple seasons if that happens. I know that they've talked about the Civic Center, the old Civic Center, as far as maybe being able to do indoor soccer there, but it apparently was very disruptive to the interior of the building. So they were going to change, because the Y wasn't enough to accommodate the adult schedule piece, but if they put the school into it, the new school, they were talking about maybe being able to expand soccer to a year-round kind of a program. But
well, Kennedy has it on Sunday. I think that's adult.
Well, I know they're very limited times, and there's a lot of interest. And yeah, so I'm thinking if we have an actual one that's more set up for it, maybe we can even expand it, because I think there was a desire to, at least in adults, and I can't imagine it would be any different with the kids, that year-round soccer would be pretty big deal.
You'll see in the cities the big domes, and they have artificial turf. It's a lot different than practicing on hardwood and bouncing off walls,
yeah,
which, you know, is not part of the standard soccer field at all. So it's indoor soccer is a real adaptation.
Okay.
But there are enough people of interest that they would happily play year-round.
Sure.
However they can
I think Mr. Stauffenecker and the coach for the soccer team and Cardinal Pride president, and I was invited, couldn't make it. They're talking about trying to organize to build something for like indoor use, and they're trying to figure out how to fund it and how to get excitement for it. It's in its very infancy startup right now. They're just getting together, Steve Brizendine, talking about, you know, what to do and how to do it and try to build some enthusiasm for that. There is a enthusiasm for that sport, not only here, but nationally and worldwide. So they want to try to accommodate that.
I was at the semifinals. The high school boys went to state last year in high school, and I saw them beat their arch nemesis, Orono, at Orono. It was a great game. And it's just terrific to see the all those guys working as a team. Best integrator in the city.
Now, with this league that you reference, are they integrated teams? You know, it's not just Somali, Zanwan, and
they're no. It's all mixed up.
Okay.
It's all mixed up.
Yeah. Adults do that.
Right.
And, you know,
kids do it well.
The teamwork is critical, even if you've got great players. If you don't have good teamwork, you're dead.
That's with everything, you know.
So they really do learn to cooperate, work together.
Thank you, Mr. Moody. No updates? Shortly. Shortly.
Define shortly.
He did say he has about a 20-minute presentation, and then the rest will be for questions. Rest of the time will be for questions.
So do we need this? They never told me they were doing that. Do they need the screen down?
No. Okay. No, I don't think so.
He's just going to talk.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
No, I think our interest is in sanctuary city kinds of issues, and I guess
right.
I'm just curious how you can break that apart. I mean, how are there issues in the sanctuary city concept that we can implement or that we can,
right.
Apart from calling Wilmer a sanctuary city, which isn't going to happen.
Right. Because I think, too, what we've been asked to do and what, you know, what we've talked about is what recommendation or what statement can come from this commission to the city council. And, you know, what? How do we move that forward? And, yeah, that is what we want to know.
And, you know, there's, from what I know, which, again, I'm no expert, right, but there is, say, an ordinance that the city council might support, but then there is a police agreement, which, you know, is through the police department. So I'm not sure if, say, let's say that the police said, hey, we're going to have a community policing agreement like the one in St. Cloud. Did they decide that? Does the council have to vote on that? I'm not sure how those things work.
I say yes.
It's an ordinance.
Ordinance for sure.
But an ordinance is different than a policing agreement, right? A policing agreement and an ordinance are something different.
I believe there's a little gray area there, that an ordinance is a city-sponsored piece. It's considered to be the law of the city, and then there, the police agreement could be made between the police department and any other entity. However, the police department will fall under the authority of the city as well. Would the city be more likely to let the police enter into an agreement outside of the city making an official statement? I think there would probably be more of an appetite for something like that to happen. but it still would probably require council action one way or the other. I think an ordinance is I think there's a difference between those two things. An ordinance is very, very much at a different level, I think, than a agreement between the police and others, but I think they both would require council action. I think, Janelle?
Yes, I agree with you totally. An ordinance is kind of like a law of the city. They have to hold hearings and so forth for that. An agreement would have to be authorized by the council as well.
Well, it would have passed in St. Cloud, what, something like 8 years ago?
It was 2005 is when the agreement was.
Oh, wow.
August 8th of 2005.
Oh, okay.
So it's been in effect for almost 12 years.
And I've heard that they've got a new version and edition in St. Cloud. So okay. This is slightly, you know, they've changed it in some way.
I did get copies of both of these documents, the ordinance and, well, this agreement to our police chief.
Oh,
so he's aware of it. And I did mention we were having a meeting again, and so.
All right, thanks,
Chief. He's had it to review.
Janelle, can I have my hard copies back? Or should I just make copies again?
I can get you another one. I know I emailed them to all of you.
Yeah.
That one, I went on the website and found the remainder of it.
Oh, good, thanks. I got tired of copying.
I'll write myself a note.
Yeah, I love hard copies.
When we've had conversations with Isaiah Group, some members, I asked them how they felt about Wilmer, and they expressed to me that they felt comfortable. Wilmer's a comfortable place to be. They're happy to be here, and they, you know, they feel like they're a part of our community. One of the concerns I think we have to be sensitive about is if we go the sanctuary city route, are we creating something that's going to create disparity? I don't know if disparity is the right word. Create a target, create something to polarize the people, yeah. You know. And I worry about breaking that comfort. So I think we have to be, we got to walk softly, I guess.
But we use the phrase sanctuary city, and what does that mean precisely? Does that fall under the purview of the two things that we're considering? We know that big cities, right, are sanctuary cities, places like Minneapolis, right, Los Angeles, and so bandy that phrase around, but I don't know if Wilmer is likely to become one anyway, right? And should we put our sights to something that might be more likely to happen? Say an ordinance or a policing agreement, right? Because aren't you saying that sanctuary city seems like a polarizing, too political idea and phrase, and it may not fly?
Right. I think it might create discomfort. And
I quite agree that that term is right. Is polarizing and inflammatory.
Right.
And what we're more concerned about is to what extent would our police turn people over to ICE if they're undocumented, if they get stopped for a traffic ticket, do they get turned over, or if they get convicted of a felony, or at what level are they required to, at what level would they? And I think most people in the city, I can't speak for them, but I would think most people in the city would say, well, for a traffic ticket, they certainly shouldn't fear being turned over.
Right. But they lays it out, right? It lays all that out.
Should be clear, yeah.
Right. So again, it doesn't have the political blowback that the phrase sanctuary city has.
Yeah, and we want our population to feel comfortable in calling emergency services too.
Right.
Right.
You know, so that's, you know.
Crime rates go down in sanctuary cities. All the studies say that. Not that I think that it's going to fly in Wilmer despite that knowledge, but...
Interesting fact.
Yeah, but it's only a positive. People feel more comfortable in calling. And for whatever reason, credits are better in sanctuary cities. But I think we ought to really discuss something next week, especially once Lindsay's come, right, and we've heard.
Yeah, I think I know what, I talked to him on the phone before, and he's going to basically probably reiterate some of the things we started when we started this commission about what the roles and responsibilities are. And how we've formed is if you don't have legal counsel and you don't hire a legal counsel as part of this, those pieces, you can't enter into those types of agreements. You can recommend, and like we do, we advocate and whatnot. That's the kind of thing you would send to the council.
Question. So he's at Fifth Avenue and Kendra Avenue.
I agree with you. It's important to have some sort of legal counsel to.
And since we don't have that, we can't do those things. But you could, we could certainly send it to the police chief and saying that the Human Rights Commission recommends that you move in this sort of direction, and that's what you can do. I mean, that's, and we'll see if that's where we want to go, but that's, I think that's the authority we have. We don't have the ability to say, and here's the agreement, and we should go this route, but we definitely can advocate for a position.
Right. Especially if we see the newer version of the St. Cloud thing. Right, I'll try and get
them. And don't talk about sanctuary cities and that politically charged stuff. We don't need the politics of it. What we're looking at is the protection for our citizens.
Right.
That we're not looking for to get engaged in a...
Headlines.
No, that's not what we're trying to do.
No.
It'll be futile. We want results.
And I think the conversational approach that Isaiah takes in having community conversations one-on-one, like you pictured in the paper doing it this week.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, that's just getting to know one another on a one-on-one. And so cities need to know the individuals in the city, and I think that's an important piece. And without mentioning sanctuary city, but knowing that the support is there conversationally. And it makes a big difference when it comes down to that individual police officer when they pull somebody over.
I don't know how things would play out politically, but even if the wheels fell off and there was no agreements, there could still be agreements.
Yeah.
There's no. Yeah, you are here. All right.
Sorry.
The pen didn't wiggle. Okay. So he's in the city of Wilmer?
Sounds like he might be near McDonald's, so making his way this way.
Am I able to ask a question?
Yes, sure.
I'm Nancy Chamberlain, and I'm a part of the Isaiah group. We just met a couple weeks ago with quite a few of our Latino friends and neighbors, and we heard from them that they feel in their ethnic group about 50% of their people are living in the shadows, and a lot of them not in the city proper, but out on turkey farms and outside of the city. And so we as a group really feel that it's not only to work with you folks as a city group, but we need to work with the commissioners, and we need to talk to the chief of police and the sheriff, because it's not just within the bounds of the city where these people are living, and are scared. I mean, we heard stories of people that are scared to go to to a soccer game to play soccer because they might not signal take a, you know, signal and they'll get pulled over. So probably some of those things are not really, don't have any foundational truth to them, but there are many people that don't live within the city. So I would really, I don't know how this group works with the county, but it's not just a city. And we hope as a group to visit with the sheriff and the chief. We're going to be having a march on the 1st of May out by the Health and Human Services building, just letting the county know and the city know that we are concerned citizens and we care about our neighbors. And nothing more than that. Just basically, we want to start entering into a conversation with them. Because we don't, the stories that we heard of fear of our Latino neighbors and friends, I was very shocked. So just so that you know that the Isaiah Group is, you know, we don't see the sanctuary city thing either. I mean, we don't see that. It's just, we just have to have an agreement. Like you said, Sean, even though it's maybe not a formal agreement, maybe there can be some kind of an agreement, whatever that may be.
An understanding.
You know, when you reach to the county, that'll be a trickier business. It's a much bigger entity, and they don't have a group comparable to this group to go to, but I think it would still be accepted. And if you use this as, I mean, we'll see how all of this plays itself out, but you can certainly use this as the template. You know, if the city police come up with some kind of a agreement, that shouldn't take a whole lot of coaxing to bring the county on board, but that, I'm just being hopeful there, but you wouldn't think so. And we heard very similar stories. Yeah, they are absolutely terrible.
Okay, so the commissioner has arrived. We're going to have him sit by Lynn so he can see. Just a little going the wrong direction on first.
We understand the fear, and we certainly are concerned about that, and we're willing to address that, but are there examples of arrests, people being turned over to ICE? Is the county, the sheriff, and the city cops, are they misusing their power? Do you have stories of that?
We didn't hear that.
Thank you.
No. Whether there is or not, we're not sure. Welcome. But that's still a real fear to me.
Yes, I have fears. Somewhat separate, but somewhat resilient.
Yeah, I'll take each one of these.
Before we get started, I'll let you know that we can stay in the facility as long as we need to. I have the keys.
Oh, so you're not going to turn the lights on. That's always good to know. Always good to know.
Don't feel rushed.
Right.
Well, welcome, Commissioner Lindsay,
to
the Wilmer Human Rights Commission. We have several guests in the audience today as well. Would you like the commission to introduce themselves?
I think that'd be great.
My name is Crystal Dolliger. I just turned over chair to Shelley last month, so we're all kind of just about been here a year. So.
Okay. And I'm Shelley Huseby.
I'm Janelle Summers. I'm with the City of Wilmer. I'm the Sheriff's Assistant. So.
Okay.
Lynn Trevaglio.
Okay. Lynn.
And Joe Benson.
Okay.
Sean Besky, also on the Wilmer City Council.
Okay.
Fernando Alvarado, I'm on to the City Conference.
I'm Marlon Breams.
And I'm Farm Little. I met you up in September.
Number. No. Cold Spring.
Yes. Okay. Nice to see you again.
Nice seeing you. So I take it there must be 7 members on the city council so you don't violate open meetings law.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's actually
we have 8.
Oh, you have 8. Okay.
Yeah, so we're okay.
Well, I appreciate getting the opportunity to come. Apologize getting turned around. I saw, I guess, the other end of the train track on Trot Avenue.
Wanted to give you a little bit of background as it relates to the Department of Human Rights. I do have some additional materials, and I think I might have just enough for everyone in the audience, but if not, we can make sure we get copies to folks. Give you a little background as it relates to the Department of Human Rights. There's some materials about some of the activities that we've been involved in. One, the civic engagement that I'll talk a little bit about as well. Most people know the Department of Human Rights, three primary duties under the Human Rights Act. The first two is to investigate claims of discrimination. Second, primary duties to ensure equal opportunity exist on state contracts and contracts with major metropolitan agencies. And that's ensuring job opportunities as well as fair pay for women under those state contracts. And the third broad area under the Human Rights Act is to use education to eliminate discrimination and disparate outcomes. In the last couple of years, I have been commissioner since March of 2011. We have been given additional statutory duties and responsibilities. One of those has to do with ban the box. So to the extent that you're a private employer, you have to delay the time frame in which you ask for criminal history information. Doesn't mean that you can't use it, but you can't use it at the beginning of the application process and not give the individual an opportunity to sort of explain the circumstances. The other is we sit on the Minnesota Emerging Entrepreneurs Board, so we try to grow small businesses throughout the state of Minnesota, and we partner with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the Metropolitan Council, and then there are seven other public members that are members of that respective board. We also sit on the School Bullying School Technical Assistance Council. So Commissioner Kasulidis and I, Department of Education, we chair that council and we seek to provide information to school districts to try to address school bullying incidents throughout the state. And then in addition to that, then we serve on a variety of different task force. And the variety of task force primarily come through executive orders, but not always, but primarily that is the case. On this sheet that you have here on sort of the then and now, on the left-hand side it says new activities 2012 to 2016. So the Diversity Inclusion Council, executive order by the governor, the department was asked to do an assessment of inclusion area efforts as relates to the cabinet level agencies. So we undertook that activity of the 24 administrative agencies. The Homelessness Task Force, again created by executive order to try and address homelessness throughout the state. There's eight agencies which participate on that task force, and then we partner with county and city governmental units. The Olmstead sub-cabinet, again, not as relates to the county Olmstead in Minnesota, but refers to a Supreme Court case talking about the segregation of people with disabilities. So this task force is really charged with ensuring that people with disabilities are engaged in all walks of life throughout the state of Minnesota. Reducing Recidivism Task Force, addressing, again, very closely to our work with Ban the Box to ensure that people do not recidivate or come back to a life of crime. And the last one is Tribal Consultation Policy. So there's 11 federally recognized tribes within the state of Minnesota. We have a liaison that we work with to coordinate communication with the 11 tribes to ensure that human rights issues are addressed within the federally recognized lands, and then also the lands within what we call the borders of the state of Minnesota. Let's stay with the then and now. When I started as commissioner, the discrimination complaints the 4 years prior to becoming commissioner was 1,080. The first 4 years after becoming commissioner, we completed about 2,700 investigations. If you go down to the average time to complete under the efficiency piece, we went from 430 days to about 290 days. We had actually dropped it down to about 255, 260. About October, November of this past year, we saw an increase in the number of cases in our workload, and we've kind of seen that continue on, which has caused more time for us to be able to complete investigations. The drop of cases older than a year, we had seen that again about 4 years ago, 228, dropped down to 64. We've now seen an increase over 100 given to the number of additional cases coming into our inventory. Most of the cases that we investigate are disability discrimination cases. That is regardless of the subject matter area. Subject matter area for us employment, healthcare, education, real estate, contracts. Within the subject matter areas, the most common discrimination complaint that we have is an employment discrimination case. And about 55 to 70% of the cases in our inventory at any point in time are employment-related cases. But it's employment, still the most common one is a disability discrimination complaint. If it's outside of employment, still the most common one is a disability discrimination complaint. Depending on when you ask me and what day of the week it is, either race, gender, or age will be the second most common one, but those would be close throughout. Any questions? Just generally over, well, let me say one other thing about the complaint process. We really treat the process for us is that we're a neutral fact finder. So to the extent that someone comes to us, we do an investigation. We come at it as a neutral party. Once we have made a determination after completing our investigation, if we believe that discrimination has occurred, we will attempt to resolve the dispute. If we're unable to resolve the dispute, we'll then coordinate with the Attorney General's office. And the Attorney General's office can then bring a case on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Most of the cases that come to us actually are no probable cause determinations, not probable cause determinations. Most of the cases in which we find for a probable cause determination, I would say about 98, 97% of those cases get resolved without having to involve the Attorney General's office. We try to take care in drafting the respective decision that we give to the parties. We've gone from about 2 pages on average to about 5.5, 6 pages, and that provides more factual background and a little bit more of the legal explanation as it relates to why we reached our decision. We found that that's been helpful to the parties to be able to bring closure to the respective dispute. Most of the folks that bring charges to us are low-income individuals, and by low-income individuals, roughly ballpark about $13 or less an hour in which they're making. Sometimes it's even less than that. So any questions just sort of on the investigation piece?
What do you attribute to that big jump in investigations once you took over?
So part of it, my background, I came to the Minneapolis to work as an attorney. So I had some experience as it relates to the Department of Human Rights. And the department has historically been underfunded, and it has been challenging for it to be able to complete all investigations. Some of the things that I had learned being in a larger firm as it relates to interacting with paralegals, we kind of brought some of those things to bear. Some of the things from experience from legal writing at the local law schools, we kind of brought some of those things to bear. We addressed some of the issues of the initial meetings. So the initial two meetings became more efficient and identifying the key documents and the key people in which to talk about. So earlier on, you're able to identify whether the case had merit or not sooner into the process. I would say those were probably the biggest drivers. The other one, equal pay and workforce equal opportunity under state contracts. So if the State Department or agency builds a building or we build a road in which there are dollars from the state, and then we're supervising that project, then our workforce participation goals would apply. If the state of Minnesota gives the city of Willmar dollars in which to build a building, then our workforce participation goals do not apply. The other major metropolitan agencies which our goals apply to, and there's four, there is a Metropolitan Sports Facility Authority, so where the U.S. Bank Stadium, the project goals applied to that project. The Metropolitan Airports Commission goals applied to that. The Metropolitan Council, so the light rail. And then everyone's favorite in Minnesota, the Metropolitan Mosquito Control Commission. So those four major agencies are goals attached. We really see our work in construction sort of as a microcosm as it relates to the larger conversation as it relates to demographics and workforce. So every day in the United States now, 11,000 people, give or take one or two, turn 65. And to the extent you were looking at the individuals between the age demographic of 15 to 64, they represent about 64% of the individuals within our population. That number is going to shrink down to about 57-58%. So to the extent that you feel that it's tough to find good workers and talented workers in the next 10 years, that is even going to be more difficult. And then to the extent challenges as it relates to that what the department sees as relates to or issues that individual disabilities see that the department partners with, we're probably also going to see an increase in that as well as it relates to the workforce. If 10.9 people currently now in Minnesota identify as a person with a disability, and on average about 40-45% of the individuals over 65 would identify as a person with disability, and by 2030, 1 in 5 Minnesotans will be over 65, you can see that there will be an increased challenge as it relates to sort of our workforce going forward. In the space of construction, why I mentioned it is because we adjusted the workforce participation goals from 11% to 32% in Hennepin and Ramsey County. And for that, that would be 32% of the total hours on a construction project. We'd be looking to see that those would be performed by people of color. When we initially announced that goal, I think that was very difficult for a lot of people within the state of Minnesota to perceive that there was that amount of potential labor to be able to do those construction projects. But when we started talking about the overall demographics within the state, more and more people understood sort of what was going on in the state and had already started to go on, because none of us is born at 18 years of age ready to go to work. The interesting thing, if you take a look at the construction workforce sort of then and now, is that when we adjusted the workforce goals inside Hennepin and Ramsey County and then the 5 counties around, we also adjusted it for Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Scott, and Washington, the 5 counties around Hennepin and Ramsey, to 11-22%. There were some folks who thought that we would probably drive down the construction workforce participation for people of color. But what actually happened is that in all 7 of the regions within, well, 6 of the 7 regions within the state, it increased, and the one that it fell short by less than 0.5%. So a couple things that we take from that is that there's already been a shift as it relates to demographically people leaving sort of the workforce and a variety of reasons why they're leaving the workforce, in that the workforce that's coming in, upcoming of age, is very different and diverse. And then we also see, because we're not only monitoring construction projects but other projects, we're seeing employers do things very differently as it relates to recruiting people and trying to retain people with disabilities that we had not seen before. And again, as I say, the construction piece is just a microcosm of sort of this conversation in other areas. Let me say one thing as it relates to the auditing work that we've done with contractors. We ask questions as it relates to reasonable accommodations, ask questions as it relates to, do contractors know the Department of Employment and Economic Development can make referrals for qualified individuals with disabilities? Contractors did very well as it relates to knowing the obligations of reasonable accommodations under the law, but as it relates to knowing that deed was a resource, they weren't as familiar. So on that score, it was probably about 60-70% of the contractors did not know that. The good side on that story is that once that we identified that as a resource, they were very happy to sort of utilize it going forward. That's real quick as it relates to sort of the contract compliance piece. The education piece, in some ways, this is kind of akin to what I would say the local human rights commissions throughout the state. When I started as commissioner, I think there were 41 local human rights commissions. The governing body for local human rights commissions probably went by the board maybe about 2 years ago or a year and a half from regularly meeting. So I'm not quite sure exactly how many local human rights commissions. I think it's about 37 or 38 within the state. The civic engagement effort. When the governor asked the department to be involved in ensuring that inclusionary efforts were being made by all the cabinet level agencies, we said if we were a business or a company, it would be tied to sort of how the company brands itself. Well, the state of Minnesota doesn't really brand a product such as Coke or Pepsi or things that are sold at Target. What it really seeks to interact with people in the public is engaging them in the public policy context. And what we found is that in the early development of policy in 2011, 2012, sometimes agencies weren't intentional enough to ensure that people were brought in on the front end of public policy development. In some cases, that was because of a historical lack of trust. The government would work for people and would listen to them, and there was a need to sort of ensure that trust was there. Sometimes it was difficult just because agencies didn't have the resources available to actually engage in real meaningful public engagement. Sometimes it was a challenge as it relates to data. Government is good as it relates to giving tons of data, but not always helping you sift through what the data means from a practical standpoint. So we encourage the governor within his executive order talking about being inclusive to ensure to create a civic engagement committee, to have all the administrative agencies in the cabinet be intentional in their efforts to create opportunities for every citizen within the state of Minnesota to be engaged in their public policy development. So this is kind of the steering plan, so to speak. This is really the first time the state of Minnesota has ever done anything like this. We as a department are very proud of sort of the work and sort of helping to lead their respective effort in this space. We think at its core, it's very simple in that sometimes the best solutions to problems probably reside most often with the people who are being impacted. And if government is in a relationship where it's really two-way instead of one-way, because we can all think of a situation which we're in a relationship in which that person always decides when we go to the movie, what dinner we're going to have, what time we're going to go home, what we're going to maybe listen to on the radio. It doesn't really sound like a great relationship that we want to be in, right? So how do we make it more reciprocal that it's two-way? So for us, this is really that kind of plan, that type of strategy. There are other questions that I probably could answer for you. I don't want to overload you with too much information, but I want to give you kind of a high-level overview of what's been going on in the department. More than happy to sort of answer any questions that you have or take questions from folks in the audience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this commission has been in effect since February of 2016, so just over a year. Mm-hmm. And we've spent the year doing some educating ourselves, having different people come in and talk to us, you know, the police department from Willmar, some different groups that have talked to us. We had someone from the Human Rights Commission from St. Cloud come and talk to us. And I guess we have a list of questions, but we really are wanting to know, you know, what our roles is, what our boundaries are, what we've had now. Some things have bubbled up in the last few months since the new presidential administration has taken effect over wanting us to present a recommendation for an ordinance or a policing agreement with the city of Willmar through the council. And so did you have a chance to look over the questions that we sent, or can we just kind of go through those? And
yeah, just feel like if you want to ask, you okay. want to answer it that way, or
however you want to do it. Just, I guess we're just looking for some direction from you as to how to move forward on some of these issues and some of your thoughts.
Sure. Yeah, more than happy to do that. We can take through the okay. questions, but just generally for the audience, the local human rights commissions that I mentioned earlier, that mm-hmm. number in the high 30s, there's no specific relationship. Let me say this, there's no statutory relationship between the Department of Human Rights and, for example, the Willmar Human Rights Commission.
Okay.
So it's not as if I can sort of deputize or sort of use the great talent that you have around the room here to do investigations on my behalf.
Right.
So your power, your genesis is in this case coming from the city. most often it comes from cities. There are a couple of human rights commissions around the state that I'm aware of that it comes from the county. And sometimes the Human Rights Commission is maybe serving a larger geographic area than a city, but somewhat short of a county, because it's some dynamic between respective mm-hmm. cities.
Right.
So I just give that to say some of the questions are probably going to be referred back to that right. document, which then created you. Now, that being said, very often it is the case that people ask the Department of Human Rights how to participate in the political process because they don't view that the political process isn't working. So as a member of the governor's cabinet and as a member, a public official in that way, so to ensure that people are heard and that they understand how that they can positively impact it and view the creation of government which suits them. So from that vantage point, we're always participating in those types of discussions. Now you want to ask me the hard questions.
I mean, you know, because I guess we're getting some like one-off questions too.
Yeah.
And you know, one of our first ones was someone, you know, came to one of our commission members with a labor issue, something with an employer, mm-hmm. You know, that they saw as an unfair labor practice. But they come to the Human Rights, mm-hmm. to a member of the Human Rights Commission, you know, or we're told about a local business mm-hmm. that refuses to serve someone who's East African.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a commission, do we? I mean, what is our extent? What is our power? What would, as the Commissioner of Human Rights, what would you recommend we do in those individual situations?
Yeah. So we have Jonathan here from my office in St. Cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So we can give contact information.
Okay.
So you can contact Heidi Hovis, who is an attorney. Not everyone who is an investigator for me who is an attorney. Heidi is someone who has more than a dozen years of experience as an attorney. So she would be charged maybe with the responsibility for investigating those particular incidents. So the first one, as someone who's trained as an employment attorney, back in 91, when you say labor, I'm always torn of whether that means there's a collective bargaining agreement and there's a dispute there, or if there might be an issue concerning no collective bargaining agreement, but there's an issue concerning not being able to take time off under the leave policy of the employer. So we have to kind of ferret that out. If it rose under the collective bargaining agreement, that might be something that we would coordinate with the Bureau of Mediation Services. They might be the proper agency to resolve it, but if not, we would be able to. The nice thing is, you don't have to worry about that. All of us will figure out what bucket it belongs into. As it relates to the issue of not being properly served within a restaurant, so for us, we would view that as a violation of the public accommodation provision within the Human Rights Act. So for us, public accommodation, being able to go to the restaurant of your choosing, being able to stay at the hotel of your choosing. No one should be denied those rights on the basis of the protected class status which exists under the Human Rights Act and under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So again, that's something in which we can take on. There are times in which an individual could say, I wish to exercise the rights maybe of a federal agency. Or sometimes they might say, I want to exercise my rights as with a state agency. So again, we can walk people through that, and then they can make the informed decision as it relates to how they wish to proceed. I am aware that there are some potential changes as it relates to how aggressive or not aggressive the federal government may be. So there may be more individuals who are seeking to exercise the ability to pursue resolution of their dispute with us, as opposed to going to the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Justice.
Okay. How can we, as a commission, be more involved in the issues of our community, and what is the extent of our involvement?
Sure. One of the reasons why we were working on the civic engagement is because we think that this is a pretty good prototype as relates to how cities or counties may wish to engage more citizens involved in public policy issues. You know, about 15 years ago, I was in an event in which Sue Dosel, who was the court administrator, gave out this fun fact that there were 2.7 million filings in the state of Minnesota. So I always use that when people say, well, we couldn't you just get involved in this little ordinance or a little and then you realize how many little ordinances or little things are going on within the state of Minnesota. It's literally millions. So to that extent, how can we be helpful in kind of providing a framework for how citizens and government officials can interact and then find best solutions for them? So that's in essence what we are suggesting maybe with the civic engagement. Does it have to be as in-depth? No. But it'll give you some ideas as it relates to the role in which you can play. And fairness within the conversation, I like the fact that you have city council members who are here. I know that there have been some instances in which city councils have not always been friendly to local human rights departments when they have sought to engage on public policy discussions.
Okay. Do you have suggestions on how we become more knowledgeable as members of the commission?
So we have historically invited local human rights commissions. We'll do it again, funding willing. It relates to the Humanities Center. What we did there is we brought individuals, Kathy Tenbrook from the Homelessness Initiative, Darlene Zangara from the Olmsted sub-cabinet. I think we brought in someone from DEED on workforce alignment. So it gave the local Human Rights Commission members an opportunity to see how some cities, counties, and the state were tackling issues which they were probably hearing or concerned about within their communities. And again, I don't know what the driving issue is here within Willmar. Is it an issue on integrating people with disabilities? Is it an issue concerning homelessness? What is that issue? We don't pretend to know all the answers ourselves, but we at least might be able to point you in the right direction.
Okay. Perhaps an organization like Isaiah comes and talks to us. Are we as individuals allowed to work towards those goals of those organizations?
As long as you're not prohibited by your respective local charter, but there is nothing under the Human Rights Act which would prevent you from doing that.
Okay. Without legal power, can the Human Rights Commission support certain issues like community policing agreements or sanctuary ordinances? And that is one of the issues here right now that we've been asked to do.
So what was the first one? Second one was sanctuary cities.
Or community policing agreements between police departments and organizations.
Right. So not to punt on all of these, but a lot of these are going to be determined by sort of what the local governing agreement is between you, in this case, the city. Generally speaking, the community policing one, if you're interested in participating and seeing what kind of conversations are happening around the state, the governor formed an executive order task force. I believe we met late November, early December of last year. We have met four or five times, and there were some recommendations which came out of the meetings over this last 6 months to provide some more training dollars through POST Board, which is the police officers. I'm always going to forget what the S is, but it's the Police Officers Standards and Training Board. So what they can be reimbursed for training. So that was a specific ask that came out of that task force that's now sitting in the Senate Judiciary, and there's also a companion bill, I believe, in the House. Different amount of money, but they're at least both in both chambers. So that would be a space if you're interested in kind of finding out what are people talking about as it relates to community relation agreements, what kind of conversations are being had. It's a rich source for you, and we can definitely provide you more information. The Sanctuary City one, again, it's probably going to be something that you want to talk to your city attorney about as it relates to what the potential posture of the city is, given some comments from federal officials as to what they may or may not wish to do. So I wouldn't want to opine in that that space for you.
Okay. What is your stand on how communities in Minnesota should approach undocumented individuals?
So for the Department of Human Rights, within the enforcement case summaries, so in this document, what we did is we took what we viewed as sort of some high-level cases within the various areas in which we had found probable cause determination. I give this as a reference to you because within these materials, we talk about are individuals who are undocumented, are they protected under the Human Rights Act? And the answer is yes. So the answer is also yes under Title VII as it relates to employment. The specific case that's in the enforcement summaries, I think it's called Ruiz, R-U-I-Z. And within that case, a married woman who was undocumented, a male manager wished to have her engage in various sexual favors. And it wasn't the first time in which she had asked for various things of that nature. This was a situation in which she brought the concern to us. We investigated. We made a finding of probable cause and took some other remedial measures in that case. I think that case is emblematic of sort of the tension around undocumented workers within our country. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that there may be some individuals who see that as an opportunity to potentially exploit those individuals, and our criminal laws or our civil laws would say that we should afford some level of protection, what level of protection should we afford them? And this is an open question. At the federal level, there has been some conversations that investigations that departments such as ours would do in that space where the activity could also constitute a criminal violation. 5 years ago, that might have been something where that individual who participated in our investigation might have been able to apply for a U visa. I'm not sure if that's going to be the case going forward. I just don't know.
Okay. Are there other questions?
That is a great concern to us.
Right.
Whether undocumented people would dare to report such things. Mm-hmm. And we don't know how to, we've been asked to address that. How do we make the community feel more safe so that they dare to report abuses like that? But we certainly don't want to make assurances that aren't valid either.
Yeah, so what I can say as it relates to our department is that we don't share information with other law enforcement entities. So if someone were to come to us because they felt like they were being discriminated against by their landlord, being discriminated against by their employer, discriminated in the basis of sort of the provision of healthcare services, and then we would investigate that matter and then we would bring some type of action on their behalf. One thing which I did not say at the beginning as it relates to charges which are filed by the department is that unlike a criminal or a civil complaint where it says Kevin Lynn, John Smith versus John Doe, and you kind of know who the parties are, the Commissioner of Human Rights has the ability to bring a claim on behalf of the state as a Commissioner of Human Rights. So I don't do it on every occasion, but I have done it in the past, in which the complaint just simply reads Commissioner Kevin Lindsay versus individual who's alleged to have discriminated.
Locally, this body has been given the authority by the city to basically educate and advocate, more or less. Does this body have the authority, if we hear and we have heard some terrible stories, and if this body deems that part of that advocacy is to bring forward a claim, and perhaps the person would not want to bring it up individually, we can bring that up on behalf of that individual and file that, and then have the St. Cloud area or the State Human Rights Commission deal with that issue?
Yeah, so let me give you clarity as it relates to this. Okay. So to the extent that someone were to come to you and say that they have been discriminated against or have been done wrong, what you should want to do is sort of communicate as soon as possible to the Department of Human Rights or have them contact an attorney to preserve their rights. Because if you wait beyond a year from the bad act, they could then potentially lose their claim. And so attorneys refer to as the statute of limitations has run. So we want to make sure that we avoid that. If you come to the department and we begin the process of filing, that in essence stops or tolls the statute of limitations from running. The Minnesota Supreme Court, I think last week, just issued an opinion as relates to an employer who files an internal complaint, tolls the statute of limitations from running in the employment context. So I give you that just to say, even as attorneys, you have to stay on top of it as it relates to knowing when a viable claim exists and not. And you don't want to be in a position as a commission having to worry about or taking on that responsibility. That's one in which go ahead, just contact the department, and then we can help facilitate.
Because I see that most of the time, perhaps a growing concern here, that those that would probably bring claim or have one would be perhaps undocumented in the fear of a local pursuit of a legal counsel would without them, and there's great fear to bring that claim, and we don't want to see the claim go unfiled. And so it's assuring to know that if we bring it elsewhere, we can do that, and that it will be dealt with that way, because the fear factor here is amping up fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm. So Jonathan, maybe to his advantage or maybe to his disadvantage, he's now been with me on about 3 or 4 weekends in the last couple of months in which we have sat down with folks who are very concerned as relates to actions which might be taken by the federal government in that way. Sometimes we have had individuals from the legal clinics, from the law schools, coordinate potential power of attorney agreements for individuals because of some concerns that they have. So it's very real.
Do you have contact information for St. Cloud for this area?
Is that readily available? Yeah, we can get that information to you.
Has there been any interest in your office of, I know you don't get directly involved in the local things, but have you been sort of a clearinghouse for those local units to get in contact? Because before you got here, I was asked to contact with Austin's Human Rights Commission. They said, we heard Wilmer is a model of what a Human Rights Commission is.
Nice. Very good job.
We're like, we don't even know what we're doing.
That's good leadership. All right.
You hear me, we've risen to the top. Yeah. But I'm curious, you know, because being so, we're isolated. I mean, there isn't a mechanism by which they are all under an umbrella to know what issues are out there and where you would find advocacies and where you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Is very difficult, I have found, very quickly in this arena. You know, and Austin gets a hold of us because they go, you have similar demographics, maybe we can compare notes. So I get that, but don't just look at the picture of the city. I mean, there are other issues that other cities may be dealing with the same thing, but any advice on there or what has been done or what could be done?
Yeah, just so that we're clear, I'm not saying that we would not partner or not collaborate, because we're hoping that this is part of a long-standing sort of effort to collaborate and partner going forward. Sometimes at the department we get calls which really aren't discrimination-related claims or claims that we should be handling. My sense is that the local human rights departments or commissions probably get similar calls that are probably like zoning matters, right? So to our sense, we want to try and make sure that it's right in our wheelhouse as relates to the issues and concerns. There is also the issue, too, is that we have found is that sometimes cities wish to come to slightly different end results on a problem, and that can be okay. as long as it doesn't, you know, violate the law. So from our vantage point, we want to make sure that we're allowing the great experimentation of cities to take place. So we don't want to necessarily say because we were in Austin and they did it this way, that Wilmer has to do exactly that same way. So that's kind of more of the, from my vantage point, not wanting to get too intimately involved in how you resolve a respective issue. But as it relates to the framing kind of issues concerning the federal law or the state law, we're more than happy to figure out how to partner within that area.
We had an issue with, we had Health and Human Services, and we had an issue of access. And for our Somali local folks or Koran, people, they were having problems with translation issues and access there. There's probably not a legal issue there, but if there are other communities that have dealt with similar kinds of things of how do you deal with translation issues when there's obviously no budget to probably hire someone for translation issues. We went through the process, and I think we've come up with solutions. We sat people in the room, which is nice, but it would have been very nice to know, oh, well, Rochester dealt with the same kind of an issue, and here's how they did that. But it's hard to get those things because it is such a local thing. You know, and I'm a scientist, so experimentation is nice with a local experiment. But to be quite honest, if someone's already done this experiment successfully somewhere else, copying it would be very flattering for them, and it would be a lot easier for us.
So to that extent, I do think that there are some things which you can sort of copy or model for yourself as it relates to what's going on within the state. Access to meetings, actually, for people with disabilities has been one in which we have probably issued opinions about 4 or 5 in the last 2 to 3 years. And again, I'll go back to the age demographics related issue. So again, if 1 in 5 Minnesotans will be over the age of 65, there will probably be some of those individuals with hearing loss. So as someone who is 52 and someone who has a spouse who has a hearing aid, I'm feeling that I'm starting to fit into that demographic a little bit. So to that extent, what are the acoustics in your rooms? How often do you make minutes available? Individuals who are sight impaired, how do you communicate what goes on with respective meetings? So those are issues which I would say governmental units are starting to take notice of and pay attention to. At the state level, for us to be able to have materials in a format that all are able to assess is a daunting task, and we're trying to get to a point of making sure that all new documents are created in a way that they're always accessible. I would guess that most cities and counties probably don't have the same financial resources, but that will be some tension created as it relates to how you create meaningful access.
Kind of, if some, you know, we have a lot of neighbors that they're not fluent in English, mm-hmm. and if they want to reach out to your commission, are there people on board that they can talk to, or do you have services that they can use as translator to express themselves and get their points across?
Yeah, so the department has utilized the service of language lines for some of the languages which we don't have within our office. We try to be very intentional in recruiting more bilingual investigators. The department, this is a little bit of a plug, right? The department in 96 had 56 employees. Today we have 39. If we hire this other person that we recruited, then we'll be up to 40. So when you think about this sheet as relates to the new activities and things that we took on in the last 5 years, obviously we weren't doing those things back in 96. So I'd like to be able to say we have people who speak all of the 100-some-odd languages which are now spoken in Minnesota, but that's really not the case.
Right.
But Spanish, Somali, some of the more common ones we have, and then we try to use language lines to address the other issues.
Are there any questions?
For cities, city councils, and county boards that decide that they don't want their sheriff's departments or their police departments to be an extension of ICE, mm-hmm. and they decide to move forward with the policy, is it, do you have an opinion as to whether they should have an agreement or enact it through ordinance? Is there any guidance that way?
So what I would say concerning new citizens have the ability to inform their sheriff as it relates to how she or he should spend dollars, the answer is yes. I think there's an open question as it relates to, and it's not to give you the official opinion of sort of the Office of the Attorney General, but I think that there is a question out there as it relates to whether the federal government has the authority, given the 10th Amendment, to compel states or local units of government that your law enforcement officials have to now carry out the duties of the federal government on immigration. So what's the work of the states is the states. What's the work of the federal government is the work of the federal government. So that's going to be something which plays out. And I think there are individuals within the state of Minnesota that would probably be interested in working with you and sort of communicating, if that's sort of the position that you would adopt, that communication to local law enforcement.
So maybe maybe counties and cities do it differently. Some have an agreement maybe and some have an ordinance. You know, it's kind of whatever they choose or whatever guidance they feel they get.
Well, to the extent that I'll answer it in this way, as relates to what might pique my interest as the Commissioner of Human Rights, is that if a local unit of government was engaged in activities with the federal government in which individuals were being detained to support efforts of the federal government, and there was no clear agreement between the local law enforcement and federal government officials, that would potentially put them in a precarious situation of either violating the individual's rights under the Human Rights Act or their constitutional rights at the federal level. And again, cities can do what they wish to do. That would not probably be something, if I was in private practice, that I would encourage them to do.
So a lack of a local ordinance, the protection still exists in this idea of separation of federal jurisdiction versus local or state policing jurisdiction.
So we have investigated local law enforcement agencies as it relates to whether they are properly complying with the Human Rights Act and then also federal law. What I have found is that when, and this would apply also to employers, when individuals don't have guidance, don't have training, don't have clear direction, their actions vary greatly. And where their actions vary greatly, they tend to sometimes violate state law or federal law. So if I was a taxpayer, I would be concerned if people were exercising discretion in which I might ultimately have to pay for their mistake if there's no policy or no guidance. Now, again, that's not a requirement of the law, but I would submit to you that as a taxpayer, I think that's a legitimate issue to bring up and a concern to bring up.
We have about 5 minutes left in the meeting to wrap up. So, are there any other specific questions for the commissioner?
Are you hearing about like people not calling law enforcement and having bad outcomes because of that, for fear of being turned over to ICE or whatever? Are you hearing, you know, like somebody might got beat up or somebody got who knows what, but they haven't reached out to the emergency services for fear, and are you getting feedback or
So to that one, I think we have been asked by one of the local cities in the metro whether we're going to start tracking calls of that nature. We're not really set up to do something like that, but anecdotally, we don't really go to more than a meeting or every other meeting in which somebody is sharing a story like that. So to the extent that an individual knows that the individual who has lashed out or acted inappropriately is undocumented, they may wish for them to be punished, but they may not wish to expose them to being deported. So they're balancing whether they're actually going to make that call or not. I know we have sat in on meetings in which individuals have sought to go through the process of becoming naturalized, knowing, you know, being in their early 30s, forgetting that they had committed a dumb knuckleheaded thing when they were teenagers, and not appreciating that that would be something which would be flagged in the process. So I know, having sat down in meetings with some of the senators and congresspeople concerning if they could get some type of relief from federal officials, that that has had a chilling effect on people within Minnesota who now have to stop and think, do I wish to potentially highlight something that might have happened 20 years ago, which nobody on my job or nobody in my neighborhood really cared, now that I have been working at this company for a decade and I've made several years worth of house payments. So to me, I would say, I couldn't give you a hard number, but I know I go to enough meetings in which I hear stories like that, which tells me that it's occurring enough that it's a problem.
Okay. Any final comments for any big encouragement to lead us on our charge forward?
Well, I would say I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. I would say that there have been 5 or 6 human rights commissions that I have met with in the last 2 months that are doing the same thing which you were asking, listening to people within your community. How can we be more helpful? How can we create more resources? So I'm very encouraged that you're kind of having that conversation. The last thing I'll share with you, we have this one, as you're talking about, the celebration of the Human Rights Department. So it's our 50th anniversary. There will be some more information about events of that nature. That may be a great opportunity for people to get more information. In the governor's budget, we're asking for regional offices. So that may provide more opportunities for us to reach out to more people within the state. If that's something that you think would be helpful, we appreciate your support on that effort. We'll probably be having more of those conversations in the next 3 or 4 months, next 3 or 4 weeks coming up.
Thank you.
And now I know where the Historical Society
is. Now you know.
Look for the train.
Exactly. The train from.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you for coming all the way out here. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you.
Yes.
Appreciate it.
We do appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So next Tuesday at...
I'm just going to, before you wrap this up, I was going to ask, do you have any questions of us? Is there anything that you would like to inquire that we might be able to offer? Something about Wilmer or...
One of the things I'm interested in as it relates to local commissions, if there are attorneys on the board, and I don't know if that is the case.
Okay.
Most have at least one on the board. So that sometimes, I try not to get lost in the legalese, but if I do get lost, I can at least point to somebody on the commission to kind of help me out. I think for us, we'll make sure that we stay in contact. In these conversations with people, we have really sought to and feel now that we want to create maybe a point person to maybe be the liaison to local human rights commissions. We'll probably have another meeting with the U.S. Attorney's Office. We had one in December, and the follow-up on that, we may have some additional information in which to share as it relates to immigration-related issues. I'll leave you guys with cards.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. So we will meet again next Tuesday at 5 o'clock to kind of review what we have been asked and what we learned today. I really would encourage all of us to specifically go over this engagement plan and the other documents that we have. Talk to Janelle about working on the minutes as soon as possible. But without anything else, do I have a motion to adjourn? Do I have a second? Okay. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned. Yes.
And then Jonathan also has some cards with our St. Cloud office.
Okay. Thank you, Josh.
So how long do you think you have an office in St. Cloud? It's dependent on funding?
Depends on funding.
I know when I talked to you, you said, well, till June, but June's around the corner. How will we know when you disappear?
The House bill has a cut of 24% for the department.
Okay.
The Senate bill has 80 to the good for us. So we'll have to see where that ultimately lies.
Yeah, I know that was a concern when
thank you for coming.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.